All right, y'all. I'm here with Dr. Grant Tinsley of Texas Tech. And the reason that I've been trying to talk to this man for so long is that he's published his lab. Not you're either the last author or the first author on a lot of these papers. You've published a lot of the articles that I cite when I talk about the nuances of body composition and how we can potentially use these things and maybe how we might want to be a little less dogmatic and sure of ourselves when we're talking about body composition analysis. So I've been super excited to have this conversation with you to talk about how we can potentially use these things, I guess more ethically, but also just more pragmatically and better as coaches. Like in your mind, if you're thinking about the body composition techniques that are available right now for the coach, I mean, we probably don't have access to MRI. B-mode ultrasound is maybe some people have access to that, but given the things that people have access to, how, if you were a coach, what would be the body composition analysis that you would pick?
Yeah, so I'm happy to answer that. And first of all, thanks for having me on, and thanks for your patience in getting me on the podcast here. So yeah, I think on the practical side, kind of the coaching side, we know there's this huge spectrum. You might have some coaches who have unique access to techniques, whether that's through connections with academia or research labs, or again, just kind of unique scenarios. There might be some of those outliers. There are probably some people in the middle who might be willing to invest some budget in, some devices that they could use with their clients, or they might have higher end clients who are willing to pay for a particular service if that's available in their town, like go pay $100 for a DEXA scan every 6 months or a year. But you also have some on the far end of the spectrum, no unique access and not much budget. So certainly a range here. I'd say at the very low end of budget, if someone is in coaching and they want to do something in the body composition realm, that, you know, they recognize that body mass alone is not giving them the data they really need on their clients, you can start off really cheap and really simple. And this, you know, you could argue this isn't body composition assessment per se, but with some nice anthropometric assessment, something as simple as a flexible measuring tape and a decent pair of skin fold calipers. These don't have to be, you know, top end, but they don't have to be the $7 plastic ones either. But just with those two items and body mass estimates, if you're performing these in a standardized fashion consistently, if you're interpreting appropriately, which we'll get into, I'm sure, you can get a lot of value from these, taking select circumference measurements, again, skin folds at those same sites. I've kind of two bits of information here. So, you know, even if the circumference isn't changing at a given site, but you see the skin fold changing, that can give you information just by pairing, you know, two very simple things. Interpreting in the context of body mass, you know, body mass isn't everything, but you might as well collect it because it can, again, be another bit of information used to interpret. So I would say that would be on the lower end where you could, you know, easily sub $100, maybe sub $50, depending on what calipers you can find, could have, you know, body mass scale, flexible tape measure and skin folds. So I'd start down at that end. And then it's kind of incremental advances up to our far end where we have, you know, this unique coach who has access to hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment because they have, you know, friends in research labs or something. These intermediate categories are tough, and I'll say my views are shifting here. I think there's some promise for relatively inexpensive devices that would be a step up from most consumer devices. So I'll kind of pick on BIA for a minute and also say some good things about BIA. BIA, bioelectrical impedance analysis, this would be the main technology that's in like body fat scales. In general, the views these devices are not very good. We have some data on this we're working on, and largely the data will support that. However, these are often devices in the, you know, like $30 to $70 range. They're starting to be a couple devices that are kind of intermediate range. I'll mention one in particular. I don't have a particular relationship with InBody, the company. They've loaned one device to our lab previously, so I'll disclose that. But for this study we just conducted, we just purchased. They're kind of higher end consumer device. So it's the InBody H2ON. That's $350. So it's, you know, definitely more than your normal BIA scale. But at the same time, as you know, Ben, much, much cheaper than most body composition assessment devices.
What's their 770? Like $5,000? Like we're talking,
It's more than that. So it's up in the 10, 12, 14, depending on what type of discount you get. $1,000. Yeah.
So they have 3%.
Yep. And they have some intermediate models like the 270 and 570, which also for some coaches might be good. But if someone's wanting like an initial entry into a device, it might be a good place to start. Our early data on is relatively promising, with the caveat that we'll get into later that it's really hard to assess individuals accurately for body composition, but the group level data is looking good. Individual level data is looking better than most consumer devices. So I have optimism that there might be some points like this where, you know, a coach might say, you know, I'm bringing people in my facility. I want to do a little more advanced tracking than just the circumferences and skin folds. I have a little bit of money to invest. I'm going to get something. This could be another item you kind of add in with those other ones. So if you did something like this, I wouldn't say, okay, we don't care about skin folds and anthropometrics anymore. We're only going to look at this one body fat value. It'd just be another point where you're now measuring something internally. So you're not just going surface. You know, there are several assumptions involved with bioimpedance, but you are measuring something inside the body, which can tell you something that the exterior measurements can't always. Related to that, and this can be, I'll say one more thing and I'll let you interject in case we want to guide this anywhere else. But related to that, one technology I like that's related to the anthropometrics is digital anthropometry. So even, you know, if someone's very skilled with flexible tape measures, they can get very consistent results. However, especially if you're trying to assess people across different sites, or if you're having people assess at home, there's an increasing availability of digital anthropometric tools. Many of these are apps that run through your phone, and from like a frontal and a side scan can estimate anthropometrics. Some now that we're testing, you actually do a full rotation and it builds a three-dimensional avatar similar to what, like from a short video clip, similar to what we do with some of our research grade digital anthropometry techniques. There are also some of those intermediate level devices that might be in the hundreds up to a thousand. So expensive, but intermediate level devices that have very nice technology for 3D scanning. So the point here is that you can have incredibly reliable 3D scanning without particular expertise in anthropometry. So I guess point being, there's a very low budget, intermediate, where I think this is a developing area that might be relevant to some coaches, particularly, you know, coaches maybe with sort of higher end clients. And then there's that kind of unique range where it's like most people won't have a DEXA scanner sitting in their living room, but maybe you can get access to it in certain places.
Yeah, let's dig into that. So, because your lab has done a lot of research on like standardized versus unstandardized conditions, and like what are the things that can potentially make, maybe not anthropometric as much. That's actually pretty cool. Like your anthropometrics, even ultrasound of sub Q, which we haven't talked about, those seem to be less prone to the, say, eating a chicken breast and then getting in a scanner. Even probably your optics, which at UT, one of the grad students in my lab was running, essentially their dissertation was checking like fit 3D versus MRI versus DEXA versus BodyPod, because we had them all at UT Austin. And so she was looking at what is the agreement between these two, again, group level data. But so in your opinion, from BIA, because what I'm thinking about here is, so we have, number one, it's got to be standardized. They have to be fasting, morning void, right? Like that's really, really important for these BIA scanners, correct?
Yes, definitely.
And then the next thing that always goes through my mind is the potential noise in the data from the intervention itself, which is, we know now, we have three studies that just dropping people in a deficit of calories, you're going to strip glycogen and fluid over time. And so this was the big thing in Wilson's study that everybody kind of lost their mind. The keto study, which you've, I think you've published in that space as well, is he refed them carbohydrates and that in that study to try to replete fluid stores and glycogen stores. And then we also know that resistance training itself can lead to edema and fluid retention, especially in the first 4 to 6 weeks. So how do you, as a coach, if you're going to use these devices, is there a way to account for that noise? What are your recommendations there?
Yeah, so great questions. And I'll admit, you know, some of my thinking on this has been shaped by articles you've sent me. So credit to you. The review article you sent from Manfred Mueller and Anya Bosie-Westfall, who are incredible German researchers in body composition, was really informative. So I think it is complex when we're including resistance training in the, say, dietary side. So I'll start with the dietary side and then kind of add in the resistance training. You know, I think at a minimum, something that'd be beneficial would be to follow a fairly systematic procedure with how you obtain your baseline and final assessments. So like if you have a client coming on a program, instead of just immediately throwing them on the program, having a little bit of discussion of, okay, this is what we're going to monitor. This is how it's going to go. This is something I know you're a proponent of, but even coaching through, you know, like these are the magnitudes of changes we would need to see to be confident. Those types of things would be great as well. But based on some of the information they had on those early changes, I would say one, establishing a true base. If we're going into a scenario where we're going to try to gain or lose weight, first, really establishing baseline stable body weight. And they even discussed that in their review that, you know, sometimes in research, we're like, oh, that's, you know, plus or minus 1.5 kilograms. And we'll say that's good enough. But that's quite a bit of room for not being stable. So I would argue for a practitioner at the individual level, we should be able to get better than that. We should be able to get very stable body weight. If we're actually tracking diet, measuring body weight in a very standardized fashion, we should be able to get pretty steady body mass and be pretty confident that's steady. How steady? Probably context dependent, but if you could have it down at 0.5 pound or something like that, where you're pretty certain it's steady, then again, this depends on availability of assessment. So I'm not saying go pay $100 for a DEXA scan at each of these points I'm about to mention. But assuming that a context where the practitioner has access to the devices and can perform repeated assessments, what I recommend is an initial baseline assessment after that period of weight stability. Then what's really interesting is that very early phase of say up to 4 days of fluid shifts going on a calorie deficit or calorie surplus. So we'd see some fluid loss on the calorie deficit, some fluid gain on the calorie surplus. And it looks like that early phase that's emphasized in some of the literature is up to about 4 days. But I would say if you could perform a second baseline assessment 4 to 7 days after that initial baseline, that second baseline after the initial fluid changes, that might be a better place to truly consider baseline for the long-term program that's going to last weeks and months. So then I continue on this program, whether that's a, you know, surplus, a deficit, continue on for weeks to months, you know, kind of the longer, the better between assessments. But at some point, both the coach and client will want some feedback. So then perform another assessment and really, again, looking from that baseline post-fluid shift, see the changes there. It's also important before transitioning off, like say you've met the weight loss goal, to get that post assessment before transitioning off, kind of like you were just mentioning, before transitioning back to a maintenance diet, because that will impact it. So point being, there's this buffer of like 4 to 7 days on each end of the program when you're starting, when you're finishing, that you kind of want to exclude, and you want your baseline and final assessment kind of within this period where theoretically some of those fluid shifts from the very short-term entry and exit from the program would be a little more stable. So that would be my view on the dietary side. You're right that it does get more complicated if you're considering training. Now, if someone was fairly highly trained and maybe they're not undergoing a huge program shift, maybe those questions or that concern wouldn't be as large. But if you're talking, it's like someone's coming in, this is kind of their first entry into the whole deal, the dietary modifications, the training, all that. I think you know, should potentially be more cautious depending on whether you're trying to lose weight or gain weight. You could have changes that either look artificially large or that look artificially small. So I don't have the best answer for that, except that if it's a very long-term scenario, in addition to what I described, you might have that like 4 weeks in assessment and say like, okay, we're going to look at this data, but this could be where there's been a lot of noise in this first month, even including in that first baseline, if they had already started the exercise program, you know, kind of depending on the timing there. But now we're going to transition to a longer term assessment. So I don't know. I don't know what the best answer is. It's probably context dependent on whether you want to fully throw out that first, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, or if you just want to interpret it extra cautiously and prompt them. We're collecting these data, prompt them being the client. We're collecting these data, but understand these are all these things going on in your body because of the combined diet and training intervention. So this isn't to make a change. This is just to collect the data. Just to give us some context for what we see later on.
Yeah, I'm gonna kind of reflect and summarize because I love that, just that whole entire process so much. So what you were saying there was, okay, we're gonna have this initial, and it looks like, I think me myself, I have to be cognizant that I tend to be like, I tend to dog BIA and a lot of these body composition methods. But one thing that we do know that at one point in time, they're fairly good. like just ballparking body composition, like they're good enough. The problem that we're talking about right now is like multiple repeated measurements within the same person. And so what the big things that I heard there were, okay, this first measurement, if we're not consistent, it's going to be tough. And then if we can get consistent, we can get that early. If it's a weight loss client, I'm even looking for that kind of dramatic results in the first week. I'm on like, that kind of cues me in that they're in an actual deficit. And so after that's passed, then you're saying, okay, let's get another measurement. That's almost our baseline for the weight loss. And then on the flip side, if someone's a weight gain client, or they're trying to make gains, you'd want to make sure that they're in a surplus of calories so that they essentially glycogen load, they get all that fluid in their muscle. And then you want to start that process there. And then before you do your mini cut, if you're a weight gain client, or before you go back into weight maintenance, that would be the spot where you would really want to analyze for changes. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is obviously, you know, if resources allow, both on the research and practice side, this is easier said than done. But yeah, I think that would be a nice procedure to be consistent with some of those fluid fluctuations that have been documented.
Yeah. And one thing in the paper that we can link, I'm not sure if that's open access or not, but you can kind of also, in tracking this stuff, you can kind of also get an idea if someone is like that fluid shift person, because not everyone is the massive dramatic fluid shift person. And those people can be, I've found in coaching, those people can be really, really excited in the beginning. And then also they're the person that goes out to eat or they go on vacation, or they go into a maintenance or a surplus of calories for 3 days and they gain 5 to 7 pounds. And so just knowing that about the person as a coach can be really, really informative, because there's no way that you can really gain 5 to 7 pounds of fat in 2 days. Like you would have to mercifully, like you would have to like just relentlessly eat. And when I have people that see those kinds of fluid shifts, I'll show them like, this is how much food you would have to eat to actually gain 5 pounds of fat. Like it's theoretically almost impossible unless you're a pro bodybuilder. And I've seen those guys manage to eat that many calories. Now, whether the digestive tract can actually absorb them is an entirely more nuanced conversation. But to bring this thing back. So for BIA and even DEXA, this would be a thing that you would be thinking about, correct?
Yeah. Virtually all methods that people have access to I'll just leave it there. Virtually all methods people have access to.
And so there's another method that I know you've been playing with, and that's, and we're, maybe we'll get into 3-compartment versus 2-compartment versus 4-compartment, but there's a way that you have been doing like this 3-compartment field methodology of BIA to essentially look at total body water and then correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, and then checking sub-Q fat measurements via ultrasound, which essentially sub-Q fat should be like, even your caliper measurements, that should be hydration independent, correct? To a certain degree?
Yeah, I think to a degree, I'd hesitate to say that fully, mm-hmm. like, you know, absolutely independent, yeah. But on the more independent side rather than the more dependent side, yes. So I'd be happy to speak to that methodology a little bit. And just as a small bit of context, as you know, listeners may be aware, most methods of body composition, and virtually all methods that give you something like a body fat percentage, are really just dividing all of body mass into 2 compartments. So fat mass and fat free mass. And lots of devices like to call fat free mass something else because it sounds cooler, like lean mass, lean body mass. In the older literature, these were different terms, but if you look at your device and you take body mass and you subtract fat mass from it, and that value matches whatever they're calling it, lean mass, some will even call it muscle mass, which is crazy. If it matches, it's just fat-free mass. That means it's everything that's not estimated as molecules of fat in the body. So there are obviously some issues with grouping all fat-free mass together, because this includes water, bone mineral, soft tissue mineral, protein, carbohydrate. So there are lots of things there. So the idea of moving past the 2-compartment model into 3, 4 and beyond, larger number of compartments, is that we're pulling out some of these different variables in fat-free mass and saying, okay, maybe we shouldn't view all of fat-free mass as one thing. So typically with a three compartment model, the first thing we want to pull out of fat-free mass is water, because we have more water in our bodies and in our fat-free mass compartment than anything else. So traditionally, these multi-compartment models, which is really just anything with three or more compartments, they're traditionally fairly inaccessible, sometimes even in laboratory settings, but especially for practitioners. So we've had an interest, myself and some collaborators, in kind of field-friendly methods for getting some of the benefits of a three-compartment model. And those major benefits are that we're not assuming someone's water content of fat-free mass. We can actually estimate it rather than just assuming based on kind of cadaver population averages, if you can even call it population when they use like a dozen cadavers to look at this. So our field three-compartment model that we've looked at in a few studies essentially uses a portable bioimpedance technique to get body water. And then it can use skin folds or ultrasonography to get the subcutaneous thicknesses that are plugged into a body density equation. So in our actual three-compartment model equation, we need body mass, body density, and body water. So with a portable ultrasound, or of course skin folds being portable, and portable bioimpedance, this is a way that this can be implemented in the field. And we've had some promising initial results, even looking at the ones that came from our lab most recently that I was excited about was looking at this field three-compartment model compared to a laboratory three-compartment model, which would use BODPOD and a more advanced bioimpedance technique. And we were looking at actual tracking changes over time, so kind of the topic we're on here. And we essentially found that the field three-compartment model it exhibited statistical equivalence with the laboratory three-compartment model when BIA individually and ultrasound individually did not. So we saw this benefit of combining both techniques in this three-compartment model, and, you know, relatively inexpensive, all things considered, compared to the laboratory model. We saw, you know, statistically equivalent results in terms of detecting increases, say, in fat-free mass. So that's just a little bit about that method. I'm happy to dive into it more, or we can continue on our way.
Yeah. So I think that that's just cool. And me personally, I think that's such a, I mean, it feels, I've done it, right? Like I have ultrasound, I've bought BIA units where you know, you don't have the callus formation, which can get in the way. You put it on the top of the hands and the top of the feet. And it does seem like, it doesn't feel like you're going to get an MRI. Definitely doesn't have that level of sophistication. But I think you when you start to do that, you start to see, oh wow, there's some variability in this, in just one of these things. And I think people can get better at ultrasound. Like I'm kind of in this debate of like calipers versus ultrasound, and so we have two ultrasound units, and I mean, I guess you could squish fat, like depending on pressure zones, like. And I'll talk, we can, cause you have a probably more experience than I do with ultrasound. I can squish, I'm like very technical word, squishing. And I like, you'll look in the literature and they'll have like different, they'll try to measure the amount of pressure that they're putting on the skin, because this is such a big deal for muscle. And that's why I've talked to Helms about this a ton, is like, man, you got to have somebody who's really good at these, for looking at muscle thickness, because I don't think people realize how much people can gain the, like your vastus lateralis data or your rectus femoris, not even position, just overall pressure of the unit. I don't know if you've seen this, but I don't get that same, like if I squish the fat as much, squish the site as much as possible, and I'll say it not, and people not carrying a lot of adipose tissue. I think ultrasound gets a lot harder when people are carrying a significant amount of adipose tissue versus people who are leaner. Have you seen anything like that on the pressure side for ultrasound?
Yeah, I mean, so I definitely agree with the statement that you need someone who's really well trained, who knows what they're doing. Ideally, even in like a coaching or you know, working with client perspective on the practitioner side, ideally having some of your own reliability data, which we may or may not get into today, but into that in the kind of the research and scaling perspective, even like community health, things like that. But if you're an expert, if you take the time to develop the expertise in ultrasound or skin folds or anything, practitioner who's working with that same client over time, then I think there's great merit. It's so challenging in the research, even if there's some reliability data thrown into a paper, it's really challenging to know how good that person was with ultrasound. Were they thrown in there? Were they mashing on it at the baseline and then they got better at the post-assessment and now they're letting up and all of a sudden it looks like we have these large muscle changes because we're compressed at baseline and not at follow-up. It's just really hard to know. Whereas if someone has the same DEXA scanner here and, you know, that was used in another study, there are still some methodological concerns for like things that could be different, but overall I feel more confident that the results are similar across sites. So I guess I have mixed views depending on maybe whether it's a research context or context that needs to scale to other locations versus just a practitioner who's willing to invest the time to really become an expert in that technique.
Gotcha. So if you had to, so you think, and I'm kind of this mind too, I think both of them can work really well. I think Skinfold, if you get good at it, and the research would say this too, if you get consistent and your Skinfold, some of Skinfolds can be, I think it can be a very valuable measurement, but you have to put in the time to get good at it. And it's, think of it as a craft. And I would make the argument that ultrasound from a sub-Q fat percentage is probably a little more foolproof than some of Skinfold. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I would. I'm a big proponent of the visualization benefits of ultrasound. So, you know, there are some simple things. It's like you're using a lot of transmission gel. You're looking at the surface of this skin. There's some simple things you can do to pretty quickly eliminate the major, like, you know, mashing of the sub-Q or, you know, major compression. So, no, I agree. I think the visual feedback is very helpful. I think both methods present challenges in people with higher degrees of adiposity. Though I'd argue, you know, skin folds might even be more of a challenge in that setting, like trying to actually palpate and understand if you're grabbing the correct amount of tissue and the correct tissue versus visualization, as long as you have enough, you know, depth on the probe. So yeah, I would be generally pro ultrasound in that regard.
Yeah. I think of, and I've done ultrasounds and skin phone calipers on people who are, you know, 20 guys are 20 plus percent body fat percentage and females in the mid 30s plus. And I just don't think I don't find it overly useful in that context. Like, it doesn't seem to be something that I would use, because I think scale weight in that particular sense, if someone, this is with the assumption that someone's after weight loss, scale weight's going to, in my opinion, in that circumstance, scale weight and circumference measurements are going to be good enough, because you're going to see fairly linear changes if your ducks are in a row from a weight loss standpoint. And so I'm of the mind now that, like, a lot of these body comp measurements, if from a subject burden perspective, I think a DEXA could be cool there. I think an in-body could be useful there. But if this is maybe I didn't even think about like bifurcating into this talk, but I think this is probably really useful for coaches in terms of like, I think we live in this space of athletes and like tracking very small changes in body composition over long periods of time. Whereas a lot of the clients that coaches get are going to be tracking pretty robust changes in body composition over short periods of time. So what would be maybe on the most conventional, like on a BIA or on a DEXA for that main client avatar, and then we can jump to the more athlete who has more lean body mass, more fluid shifts, potentially for that person who's after weight loss, maybe even body recomposition, what type of numbers are you looking to see where you would have that least significant change, or you know that this is not noise in the data, like this is real?
Yeah. So I know this won't be a satisfying answer, but really ideally you can look up numbers in the literature, but it's frowned upon to just use numbers either provided by the manufacturer or by another lab for your least significant change, or they're related metrics, but just broadly, you know, for any listeners not familiar with these terms, we're just looking at like what amount of change has to be exceeded for us to be fairly confident this is a real change that has occurred. You know, so ideally it really has to be conducted in the lab. And the ultrasound's a great example. This would be true even of DEXA and BIA and all those. Ultrasound would be a great example that we were just talking about, where you have very different levels of expertise, different levels of precision. You have some people who could get a very low, least significant change, meaning they'd be fairly sensitive to detecting these small changes. Across a category of devices like BIA, it varies widely. We see least significant changes with some of these consumer grade devices that are so large. You know, the person would be like, yeah, no duh, I lost body fat before you ever met it. They'd be like, okay, yeah, I had to lose like, you know, 8% body fat before you realize I lost body fat. Like, I could have told you that from how I looked, how my clothes was fitting, all that. So there are some context in which within a technology, it's so large that it's essentially not any more useful than just very basic logical inferences. Now at the higher end, say we're talking InBody 770, some nicer device. If it's employed with rigorous standardization, then you could have least significant change that's down in, you know, several percent. Still, where it's a change the person might have noticed even without you saying like, okay, now we've met this threshold we consider least significant change. But again, context dependent. We've looked at, and I won't go too much in the weeds on this, but we've looked at very like minor methods things. Like one we focus on with BIA is the idea of like, should you consume water before a test? Because lots of literature will say things like, you know, participants reported lab, we assessed their urine. If they were dehydrated based on urine specific gravity, we gave them water, waited till they presented with urine that was hydrated, and then assessed them. So I've always kind of taken issue with that because you're kind of like chasing a urine specific gravity value. It's like, okay, if I drink a bunch of water, of course my urine's going to be more dilute shortly thereafter. Does it actually change the hydration of my tissues you're going to assess in the amount of time? I don't know. So we've done studies where people come in after dry fast, so consume no food, no fluid overnight. We assess them with bioimpedance, then we provide them with water, then we assess them again, and it wreaks havoc, and not always in the way you'd expect. So this was actually with a 770. So this was a modern vertical scale with a vertical analyzer with a scale built in. And that increase in body mass from consuming the water was immediately detected. It was detected exclusively as fat mass because the currents couldn't detect this fluid yet, but the scale could. Scales are, you know, very good at detecting when mass is increased. So we had this artificial increase, pretty notable increase in fat mass and body fat percentage. There's well over a percent. I think it's around 1.5% over a course of just minutes because of fluid being ingested. So if we've been following one of these protocols, we're like, okay, you know, you're a little dehydrated, you need to drink some water. Now you're hydrated. And we put someone on the scale, that dramatically be changing this estimate, whether it's a baseline estimate or a subsequent assessment. So anyways, point being that even depending on how someone's using a device, and not just how they're using the device, but how they're preparing their participants to use the device, that will affect things like the reliability and correspondingly what the least significant change would be. So that's a long, long way of saying it really has to be evaluated on an individual basis. So if you're a coach listening to this, and maybe say, I'll zoom out, if you're not into stats, you're like, I don't want to calculate anything, you can use some logical inferences. If you can get a group of your clients to come in and get assessed one day, and then come in and get assessed the next day and have them do all the same procedures in terms of rest, abstinence from exercise, food ingestion, probably fluid intake. If you can get them to do that, assess them on 2 days and do this with a small group of clients, just look how much, say, did that fat-free mass value vary from one day to the next? And you look at it, it's like some people were identical. Some people varied by up to 0.75 kilograms. Without even running stats, you can say like, okay, anything up to 0.75 kilogram change with this device, I saw from one day to the next day where I know there wasn't a real change in fat-free mass. So it'd be a very informal way to do it. You're like, okay, now I'm tracking them over time and they're worried they've lost fat-free mass, but it's only down 0.5 kilograms. We can remind them, okay, we've seen changes larger than that from one day to the next. So we're not going to jump to conclusions. We're not going to overinterpret this. So yeah, just for the practitioner who's not interested in running stats or powering up Microsoft Excel or R or anything, they're just kind of some logical inferences where you can get some of the benefits of thinking about reliability without going, you know, too far into the weeds.
Yeah. So what you're saying there is, all right, we're going to potentially try to account for daily variability inside the person on the individual level.
Yes.
And wow. I mean, I immediately go back to just drinking water can add 1.5% of body fat. We haven't even gotten into eating like sodium. We haven't even gotten into any of that. So what I got out of that is if we're going to use, especially BIA, if we're going to use BIA, that almost has to be in standardized conditions. Am I off on that?
No, you're not off. In really, BIA is a great example, but anything measuring something internal to the body will be more susceptible to these errors. You could also argue they might be more sensitive to changes in a good way that are occurring inside the body. But as you mentioned earlier, things like anthropometry, whether that's manual or digital, skin folds to a large extent. Some of those items are more external characteristics will not be as influenced. DEXA is actually one that's relatively robust to some of these standardization changes. Even though it's internal to the body, it's not, you know, the X-ray attenuation is a little different deal than just the flow of current. So yeah, no, I definitely agree with that.
I think all of that is super usable. Thanks. I just want to say thank you, because I think a lot of people have kind of worried about that. Like, should I have someone drink water? Should I have someone not drink water? And so I'm going to try to summarize and correct me if I'm wrong here. So you would probably do like one day, keep your water intake, kind of keep things really consistent, like food and water, keep things consistent, do a dry fast. That next morning would be your first measurement. Do the same thing the next day, and then get another measurement that next day. Same kind of food and water schematic, and then get another measurement the next day. Does that sound like the, in a field circumstance, even a research circumstance, that would probably be ideal?
Yeah, it would be ideal. And that what that's giving you the one day, the next day, that's allowing you to look at really two types of error. One is the technical error, the other is the biological. So when lots of people collect reliability data, they'll bring someone in, they test them on the device, they get off, they jump right back on, they test them. That's fine. That test retest reliability, that's looking at the technical error of the device itself and say like how you're positioning them on the device, or if it's skin folds, you know, how you're grabbing the folds, all that. That's nice. But by separating by one day, you're not only taking into account that technical error of conducting the test two times, but also biological error from it being one day and various things happened in the body and it now being the next day.
And I agree with that as much as possible. And some of your publications are trying to get at exactly that. Like, what is the technical error in these devices versus what is the biological error in the person? And that is super important for people trying to use these things pragmatically as coaches, and then also in the research field, trying to figure out, like, did this intervention result in a actually statistically significant, you know, fat-free mass increase or fat mass decrease. One thing I gotta like zoom out here and I gotta think about like what we just said we've been talking about jamming on this for like 40 minutes. So we as scientists, we pretty much said, all right, we need you to do a day-to-day variability test in the first 2 days. Then you got to get consistent enough to get in a deficit. Then you got to do that again 4 to 6 days later. And there's your baseline. So essentially, if we were using, we'll just keep it BIA, we would need 4 tests in that first week. And the biggest thing that you and I would both want, the word that probably pops up for every researcher, is like, we need consistency in that first week. Is that, did I summarize that well?
Yeah, you did. I would say I was viewing the test, like where they're coming in the 2 days in a row, sort of as a one-time thing, and ideally across several clients, almost more for the practitioner to understand their own error rates. And then they could even, you know, tentatively apply those ranges. Like, say again, if, you know, it varied from 0 up to 0.75 kilograms fat-free mass one day to the next. They could even, if they got collected that data well, they could apply that to other clients down the road. If you're using the same technique, say just so you know, new client, in general, this can vary by up to this amount one day to the next. But yeah, in that initial group, like those back-to-back days, and then, you know, perfect world. Yeah. That 4 days later, if you did another back-to-back days and averaged them, you're obviously reducing some of the day-to-day variability. Now I know I'm guessing where you're maybe going with this is that there's some practical constraints. Like here on the science side, we're like, yeah, we should definitely do 100 BIA assessments over the first 2 months. That's definitely what we should do. But there's some practical constraints there. And at some point, the client's gonna be like, okay, yeah, leave me alone.
And so I we talked offline before we started, is like, I'm trying to get into like the ethical use of these devices. And by ethics, I mean, not telling a Rudyard Kipling, like just sciencey enough story to people. Cause I've found that when people use these devices as coaches, if it doesn't go their way, they're kind of on their back foot, and then they're having to talk their way out of the data. And so what I like to do is I always like to, and this comes from just being wrong and screwing up, is I always want to be the person that talks about the downsides of things or the upsides of things before they happen, because then I'm kind of a wizard. Whereas if I, and I mean that in like telling people like, this is what the downsides of this data is. This is what the upside, and you've mentioned the word prompting, having that conversation beforehand. This is what we can take away. This is probably what we can't take away. Having that, you know, a little bit more nuanced discussion on the front end, so that when this person, you know, gains 2 pounds of body fat and loses 2 pounds of lean body mass 4 weeks in, but their circumference measurements are, you know, they look different, their clothes fit different, then you're not on your back foot with that bioimpedance data. You're like, okay, yeah, that's well within our error range. We could be recomping here. We don't necessarily know. That's an entirely different conversation than someone being mad at you. Like, how did this happen to me? I don't know if I've summarized that well, but did I explain that clearly?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. And I think that prompting beforehand will probably serve to kind of temper how extreme the response is on either side. So it could prompt them for like, yeah, you know, like technically you see this body fat number that's 0.4% higher than your baseline assessment, but you've prompted them saying like, if it's less than 1.5%, it could be nothing. We're not going to worry about it. But similarly, if they lost 0.8%, you know, you kind of temper that and be like, you know, it said you lost 0.8%. That's cool. This is still within the area of the device, so we're not going to overinterpret it. And, you know, maybe to be encouraging, you're, you know, a little more positive on that, you know, like it's maybe in the right direction, but we're not going to say too much about it now. But yeah, I think with that prompting, it kind of like tempers it either way. So you're not just like, oh yeah, I lost 0.8% body fat. And then the next time they come in and it's fluctuated up again. So yeah, I think in many ways it kind of serves to, I don't want to say minimize the importance of the body comp testing, but just contextualize a lot and be like, okay, for us to be really confident, this is something we're going to do over time, there are limitations, this and that, kind of like you're saying, pointing out the downsides, and just the, you know, shortcomings, just how far we can go with this. And, you know, we talked about this offline, but, and I'm sure you have more experience in this than I do, but so many other metrics are important too. Like you're saying, you know, how they're looking, how they're feeling, you know, if their diet has been on point, if their training is going well, they're, you know, all that. Body comp, I always recommend caution in using body comp as like the one variable that's causing you to switch. So if like all signs are positive and then it comes back, and it, as a side note, this is where the error can help you as a practitioner. If this value comes back and it doesn't look favorable, if it's within the error of the device, then you have more solid ground to stand on saying like, this might not be real, rather than like you're saying, you're kind of on your back foot trying to figure out what went wrong, or feeling the pressure like, okay, now I need to switch up this program because we thought it was working. Everything seemed great, but this test said it wasn't working. So I always recommend being slow to make a change based on body comp alone. Now, if you see body comp trending in the wrong direction and everything else seems to be trending in the wrong direction, maybe it's time to switch something up.
Yeah, let's dig into that, because I think this gets into a particular avatar that body composition metrics we might want to be very, very careful with, and probably like assess them over very long time periods, perhaps. So I think of someone who has a lot of adipose tissue that they want to lose, their weight loss seeking, whatever that is. I think of that like, okay, our interventions are going to overwhelm the error rates in the data fairly quickly. Like, people can lose on programs like 0.5% body fat to 1% body fat per week. So you're talking about in the first 6 weeks, and in the first, and look ahead saw this, like you could be getting at, you know, 6% body weight easily in the first 1 to 2 months of an intervention. And that BIA is going to be able to pick that up significantly from a weight loss side. I'm fairly confident that if someone loses, you know, 20 pounds, BIA is going to tell them that they lost body fat. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, I would. Okay. Yes.
So right there, the delta in the person's changes is going to be significant enough that it's the whatever device you're using is probably going to be able to pick that up. You probably could have just saw it, but maybe people like to know. And muscle is a little bit different there. And so that's where we can get into this nuanced conversation that I think really gets into, you've done a couple studies looking at this over the last 2 years, is like muscle gain, body recomposition, even gain taining, where you're staying the same weight and you're essentially trying to trade fat for muscle. What do we do?
Yeah, it's more challenging. So when you were talking about the large weight loss, I was thinking back to an overfeeding study we did where we had large fat-free mass gain. It was kind of the same deal where, you know, these individuals were gaining, I think it was over 4 kilos on average. Like they were gaining enough weight that it's like all the methods detected an increase in fat-free mass. We were looking at all these different methods and their ability to track fat-free mass increases. So they all detected that increase with varying levels of agreement. But yeah, when you have that large of a change, even the devices that aren't as good, aren't as sensitive, they're going to be like, oh yeah, you know, this person has enough body mass, enough, you know, tissue differences that we can see that. Yeah, it's much harder in the kind of recomp scenario. I'll say that we have done studies where we've seen that essentially zero change in body mass and recomp. It's hard to ever have the recomp exceed the error of the device, even with our lab grade devices. So this is a point where you kind of, it pushes you on the reliability metrics. It's like, do I fully lean on the reliability metrics and say like, you know, body mass didn't change. It looked like they gained a kilo of fat-free mass and lost a kilo of fat mass, but that's technically within the device error, so nothing happened. I don't know. Or you just say like, it appears there's recomp. These were individuals who were already trained, body mass didn't change. You know, performance went up. There are other things indicating that would align with this increase in fat-free mass. So that's a point where I just recommend like cautious interpretation, but I wouldn't fully dismiss and say like, yeah, we're going to say nothing happened, even though we saw a statistically significant increase in these two variables, just because from our separate reliability data, we would have to see a kilogram and a half change in each for it to meet the least significant change. So I think it takes some cautious interpretation, definitely on the research side. And similarly in practice though, you know, the error rates of the devices used in practice are sometimes higher. And it's also individual level accuracy is a much higher bar in terms of how we evaluate methods. There are lots of methods that might be good on the group level. Simple example, we had a recently like a $30 consumer grade BIA device, which on average across like 75 people was dead on. I think it was like 0.2% body fat different than our four compartment model, which is like hundreds of thousands of dollars of research equipment. So like if you were to just look at like, you know, run a t-test, run equivalence testing, look at the means, it's like, oh, these are this $30 device can replace our four compartment model. But if you look at the individual level variability, the limits of agreement we look at here, we're like plus or minus 10%. So that means if someone came in and they measured 25% body fat on this consumer grade device, we'd be 95% confident that they were between like 15 and 35%, which what does that even mean? You could just look at someone and say, yeah, you're between 15 and 35% body fat. I wandered there a little bit.
We'll give the scientists a bone here. So the Bland-Altman test was the group mean was great, but the Bland-Altman test, you could drive a truck through it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Cool. And that's so important. And so here's what I'm going to try to, cause I know we could nerd out on the nuances of the science all day for like probably all week. Right.
Yeah. Probably.
And so, all right. I think what you said there was really well put in that. Okay. I don't know if a kilo for kilo, I don't know if this can pick that up. And I think that's really, really important for very trained individuals because I mean, can I gain another kilo of muscle mass? I think so. I think I might be able to get another 2 kilos in my life. But like, when do I do the body composition to assess that? And so I think like from a trained, very, very trained individual, we're just going to be, I'm going to be really, really hesitant to kind of use this data. I mean, you're talking about like, we have multiple pro bodybuilders that we talk to and we work with, and you're literally talking about like maybe a 2 to 3 pound difference on stage. And there's so much subjective stuff. There's so much water weight stuff with that. I'm just going to pass it off to you and you can take this wherever you want. But whereas I think about someone in the Gen Pop, we legitimately, I looked at like your last one, tracking changes in body composition, comparisons of methods, influence of pre-assessment standardization. Like, I don't know how, like there's $1 million worth of BI, there's $1 million worth of body comp, like stuff like Fit 3D, like everything is there. And on average, in that 6 weeks of really, really solid resistance training, those cats put on 3 kilos, like 3 kilos of muscle in 6 weeks with a surplus. So some of that was probably fluid. But this kind of gets into this recomposition in the general population. Is it possible for us to pick up Longland 2016 type recompositions with these methods, like 1 to 2 kilos of fat-free mass and like 5 kilos of fat mass loss? Like, can these devices pick that up?
At the individual level?
Yeah.
I think they can. I think they can. It probably depends, again, a little bit on how strict you're being on the reliability metrics. I think a general understanding of the fact there's error in the device, even the informal way to assess reliability, as mentioning, of just looking at what range of changes you see one day to the other, all those things will help. But if you were to do kind of the strictest interpretation of reliability metrics at the individual level, it'd be hard in a lot of settings to truly exceed those changes when you're tracking individual with a consumer grade device or kind of intermediate level device. So I think we can get enough data where we're pretty sure that's happening. Again, especially if we're combining things, if we're looking at body mass, you're like, okay, body mass is decreasing, but not by a ton. You know, maybe we see body mass decreasing and we see like limb circumferences increasing and skin folds decreasing. And now we pair it with this BIA device where we see an increase in fat-free mass, decrease of fat mass. We're like, okay, we're seeing all kinds of things supporting this. It's like, okay, there's probably recomp, body mass is decreasing some. So we're potentially losing more fat than we're gaining fat-free. But we're seeing like, what could be interpreted as increases in muscularity of certain limbs, skin folds are supporting that, you know, and I know that's probably a perfect scenario where everything is aligning, but yeah, I think if you use a combination of methods and kind of logical inferences, you could definitely detect that magnitude of gains. The harder situation, you know, like we were talking about, is when it's not, you know, several kilos on each, where it's like half a kilo on each or 1 kilo on each. Those, I'm guessing you might see some other signs earlier on, like where the person is like, my clothes fit better. I feel like I look better. Like I'm happy with what's happening to my body. You might get that, and you probably know better than me on the practitioner side. You might get that feedback before the devices are saying like, okay, yeah, we're pretty sure this is going in the right direction.
Yeah. And I think we could take this right to the research side as well, because this isn't just a knock in. And I'm not saying this to dog any individual researchers. Like, I know absolutely how hard longitudinal data is, especially like longitudinal data where you're asking people to do things. Like, I know how hard that is to run really hard. Like, it's really, really difficult. So when, as scientists, I think we're very quick to jump on the bandwagon to critique things. And I always want to, like, you know, preface this with that, but you even see one of the most notorious like recomp studies in trained individuals is out of Campbell's lab. And that was, if I'm right, I think that was that was skin fold measurements. And that was like a 1-for-1 or a 2-for-2. And I'm just a little bit squeamish in anything, ultrasound, BIA. I'm just a little bit squeamish in its ability to kind of, even at the research level, at the group level, to potentially pick up that small of a recomp. And this gets into a bigger question. So that's kind of non-ideal. Is that real? Do you think that Longland using, this is us, Stu Phillips lab, using that force compartment, they had BodPod and they had DEXA, kind of gold standard, if you will. Do you think that body recomposition is real?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think there's some context there related to the participants coming in, essentially untrained, I think recreationally active, but no formal training. I think they put them on like a 6-day-a-week program between lifting and high-intensity interval training. They're looking at the two very dramatic protein intakes. Like, to me, coming in relatively untrained, very rigorous program. You know, it's, sorry, my light's here. I think it was set up to, and this is not a knock at all. It was a context in which that higher protein intake could really make a legitimate difference for lean mass. If you were to bring in highly trained individuals who are already training 6 days a week and put them on that program, I don't think you would have seen the same results. So in terms of the methods and everything, yeah, the 4C model they employed looked great. Their standardization looked great. It was a short study. I'm trying to recall if it was four weeks. Yeah, 4 weeks. So it was on the short side. So some of the questions we talked about related to like that baseline assessment, that transition into and out of the program, those weren't necessarily there though. To be clear, some of my study, really all of the studies, we haven't employed that as rigorously as would be perfect with that full transition in, second baseline, full transition out. Partially for practical constraints and partially because, you know, we're always learning and realizing the myriad things we have to control that, you know, previously, you know, sometimes ignorance is bliss. I look back to the early research days and it's like, oh, you know, there's so much I didn't know, I wasn't burned by, and now it's just increasing burden. But anyway, Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a great lab, great procedures, all that. The results are, you know, pretty profound. But again, I think it wouldn't always hold up in other contexts. I'd be interested to see it in a longer setting, ideally with that, you know, the kind of the multiple baselines and multiple kind of exit out of the program assessments that we talked about. I think you might see different results. But given the setup, I think the results were within, you know, obviously within the realm of possibility. And I have a lot of respect for Stu and his lab and the way they do things. So that's my two cents.
I would agree. So a lot of people think I'm curious if they gain. I think they gain lean body mass. I think absolutely. I think they gain muscle mass. What I'm curious of in that, if you read that study, I'm actually curious if the lower protein group gained muscle mass. I would guess, I would guess that if they refed them and like 8 weeks later did another assessment, I would bet a significant amount of money that even that lower protein group gained 1 or 2 kilos of lean body mass, because I think that they probably got the repeated bout effect. And I think those individuals were in a massive surplus. They were at a 40% energy deficit. So I would guess that they were kind of volume depleted. And this comes back. Nobody's done this since Donnelly 1993. And that really speaks to like how much people don't like to get stabbed. and so they're one of the only labs that I know that looked at myofibular versus sarcoplasmic hypertrophy in that kind of weight loss context. And I would guess that if you biopsied them, both of these groups, I would guess that the higher protein group had higher myofib. And then they probably just had overwhelmingly, maybe they gained more 5 myofibular mass. But that's my take on that. I won't go down the tangential stream too long, but I think there's two cases really where extremely high amounts of protein might be beneficial. And that's people, untrained individuals starting a resistance training program for the first 6 to 8 weeks, because they're just blowing through so much muscular tissue. And then the other one is probably people taking anabolic steroids, because they're probably in that same type of situation where they're knocking down a lot and then building up a lot of muscular tissue.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great point in low protein group. I think, because they had like the no mean change, but were in, you know, subject to some of these fluid losses we talked about between that baseline assessment and that subsequent. So yeah, I think you're right. That's certainly reasonable. If there was kind of a fluid and glycogen normalization at the end, even that short term, that 4 days or something we're talking about, that might have shown up as an increase for them and potentially an even larger increase in the high protein group.
And I would say to coaches listening, so even if your client in that window, so if you see muscle mass maintenance or over like an 8 week period, and they're marketably stronger, like they're moving more weight for more reps, and they're in a deficit, I would make the guess that they may have actually put on functional muscular tissue. Not to say that sarcoplasmic is not functional or anything like that, but I would guess even in that maintenance of muscle mass, I would guess that they actually put on muscle tissue, if you will. And then when you brought them back up into a maintenance or a surplus, they would probably fluid load, and you might be able to see that like we talked about. So I think that's one place where, like, if, like you've talked about, like multiple measurements kind of interjecting and going towards the same place. If your weights are moving up in the gym and you feel really, really good, but your muscle mass is kind of maintaining on any of these metrics, I think you're still probably in a good place, especially if you're in an energy deficit.
Yeah, no, I'd absolutely agree.
Cool. Grant, this has been a pleasure. It's been a really fun conversation. Is there anything that you feel that you want to talk about that we haven't? I want to honor your time. And is there anything that we've talked about that you want to explore more or anything you want to finish up with?
I think the only thing I'd say is to, you know, if practitioners are listening to this and this, you know, if it seems overwhelming, the number of things to consider, things like reliability, the different technologies and all that, I would just encourage you to start where you're at, kind of make incremental changes in that direction. Again, going back to the fact that you can get some useful assessments with a flexible measuring tape, some skin folds and body mass, just whatever you do, do it with excellence in a standardized fashion, understand what you're getting, you know, prompt the clients appropriately for like what you're actually looking at there. I think you can start there. And for some people, they may stay there. That may be plenty good. That may give their clients what they need. For others, they may be interested in pushing into those more advanced methods, but I would just be very thoughtful about like, what do these data mean? How much weight can we put in them in terms of the body composition side? So I think that's probably all I'd say, is just to hopefully take a little pressure off if it seems like overwhelming, like, you know, there are all these things I have to do. I have to go take a stats course to be able to like run a body comp test and talk to my client. You really don't have to, but just like thinking about this critically, you can make some logical inferences. They'll benefit you as the coach and, you know, how you discuss these things with the client, and benefit the client for them having realistic expectations of, you know, what you're looking for and what you're not looking for.
Yeah. I think someone who's just using these technologies, if I had to take away two things from this conversation, it would be like, okay, I need to standardize my initial assessment and subsequent assessment. Like, this standardization is going to be my best friend. And then the other thing is I probably want to assess the individual variability of this person in some form or fashion. And I think if you check both of those boxes, you are far and away like doing more than I've seen many, many people do in the field. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. Grant, thank you for your time. Where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, so I have a website that's just my name, www.granttinsley.com. I have links to our research publications, pictures of our lab, information about my home gym, all that good stuff there. And then in terms of social media, I'm probably most active on Instagram, and my handle is Grant_Tinsley_PhD.
Cool. And I just want, from the entire community, I know sometimes you're someone who lifts. You got a great deadlift, great physique, man. Great physique.
I appreciate that.
I just want to say, reading your papers, everything you're doing from people out here in the field, thank you. Just really, really thank you for all the work that you're doing on this body composition side, on protein frequency. Thank you, man. From the bottom of my heart, thank you for all the work that you do.
Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate that feedback. And likewise, thanks for kind of bridging the gap in many ways between research and practice. And you can engage with both sides and connect both sides. So yeah, I really appreciate what you do.
Awesome. We'll cut it there, y'all. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.